Good morning. I'm John Sackwas, the host here at All About Money on KZYX. We're broadcasting live in Philo, California from the beautiful Anderson Valley. Today is September 20th, 2013. We've got a great show. We'll be talking about the Israeli nuclear weapons industry and weapons of mass destruction at a time when we seem to have when the United States of America seems to have a double standard type of a policy against chemical weapons in Syria. Don't say a word about the 200 or 300 nukes in Israel. I'm joined in the studio by my guest co-host, Jeff Blankford. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, John. Good morning, listeners.
And Jeff, why don't you read the disclaimer, since we're sure to have a controversial show?
Yes, the views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KZYX and Z's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors.
So let's get on with our program, shall we, Jeff? Great program today. Again, the genesis for this program was it occurred to me that the United States has a very serious program with the truth in the Middle East and a very clear double standard policy when it comes to weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East. I know it's kind of the third rail to talk about the Israeli nuclear weapons program, but in speaking with and reaching out to AIPAC and the Israeli embassy and what have you, I pointed out to them there was a time when subjects like rape or child abuse were taboo. It's uncomfortable to talk about, but I think we have to talk about the nuclear weapons industry in Israel. Also want to point out on this show, I won't tolerate any hate speech, any hate mongering, anything like that. Just interested in the truth. Our first guest is Sam Husseini. Many of our guests, he is the communications director at the Institute for Public Accuracy, and many of our guests come referred via the Institute for Public Accuracy. Sam also does a lot of ambush interviews in Washington, D.C., and he's a fearless guy, and he's got my admiration for some of the work that he does. He'll come right up to Secretary of State or the National Security Director and ask things like, how come the United States doesn't acknowledge, nuclear weapons, that Israel's got nuclear weapons? And you can literally see the Secret Service detail descend on them like the angels of death. But Sam will go forth and keep asking the question, keep asking the question, keep demanding the truth, keep demanding the truth. He's a guy that needs to be on our show. Sam Husseini, welcome to our show.
Good to be with you, John.
Thank you. So let's start at the beginning here. Israel is widely believed to possess nuclear weapons, but every member of Congress and every administration person that you've spoken to says, I think they have them. I'm led to believe they have them, but I don't know that they have them because I've never touched them. What do we know for sure?
We do know that Israel has a massive nuclear arsenal at minimum. The lowest serious estimate that I've ever seen is 60 nuclear weapons. It could be as high as 400, and the capacity to make more. I've asked a lot of people this question. Helen Thomas once asked Obama at his first news conference, actually. She asked Obama, do you know any country in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons? And Obama's response was that he didn't want to speculate. Of course, nobody was asking President Obama to speculate. He clearly knows, but there's been a longstanding agreement between the U.S. and Israel to not admit, to not acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons, or for that matter, other WMDs, chemical and biological.
Right.
The funny part in this, in the current state of affairs, is that everybody's making fun of Syria for finally acknowledging that it has a chemical weapons program, which isn't quite true, because they did basically acknowledge it in 2012. They basically said in 2012, any program that we have is purely for external defensive purposes and not for use in the civil war. But in any case, it's hilarious to me in a way that people are mocking Syria for allegedly only now acknowledging this, while the U.S. and Israel and the U.S. Basically will not acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons. I've asked, you know, a whole assortment of politicos, as you mentioned, about this, and, you know, responses vary from I don't know to that's up to Israel to decide. I actually want to ask Jimmy Carter, and that was his response, that it was up to Israel to decide. And then a year or two later, after I asked him at the press club, he actually came clean in an Indian newspaper and said, yeah, it has this, and we really should be more forthright and more honest about it. John Kerry, when I asked him this, when he was a senator, when he was head of the Foreign Relations Committee, he basically said, yeah, it's well known, which was, you know, more forthright than most other people that I'd asked. And I asked him, well, so why doesn't the administration acknowledge it? And he seemed, or he pretended, that he didn't know that that was administration policy, which I find very hard to believe, given that he was head of the Foreign Relations Committee at the time. But it's interesting now that he's Secretary of State. I've been trying to get reporters over at the State Department to ask, given that no sitting Secretary of State has ever acknowledged that Israel has nuclear weapons, but John Kerry did when he was a senator. So can we finally get on with the truth here? Okay, can we finally, you know, get the State Department to acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons? And this isn't an academic exercise, because, you know, everybody's been saying that we're engaging in diplomacy now, that we didn't, you know, bomb Syria. But that's not really true. What the U.S. government engaged in was the threat of the use of force. You know, bringing it back to the money example, John, you know, you walk into a bank and you wave a gun around, you don't have to pull the trigger to be using force to get your way.
Right.
So instead of, you know, the U.S. waving its gun around to compel Syria, for example, to get rid of its chemical weapons, you know, real negotiations would be, oh, okay, well, these Israeli nuclear weapons are a concern of yours, so why don't we, you know, establish a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East and, you know, work out a program where everybody in the region gets rid of their WMDs. Syria actually proposed that in 2003, and the U.S. Ditched it. So that would be something along those lines would be actual negotiations, actual diplomacy.
I want to let our listeners know that this whole exchange between Helen Thomas and President Obama in February of 2009, where Ms. Thomas asked if the president knew of any country in the Middle East had nuclear weapons when Obama applied, he didn't want to speculate, is actually contained in Sam Husseini's article, See No Evil, The Absurd U.S. Stance on Israeli Nukes. See No Evil. And Sam, before, why don't we give out some of that information now? Where can our listeners find out more about this article and your work in general?
At accuracy.org is my day job is with the Institute for Public Accuracy, and we put a lot of information, different people on news releases. People can also just simply Google my name and my blog, and, you know, I put out a fair amount of stuff on this, including links to videos of me questioning people like Kerry, like Hagel, like Biden.
Condoleezza Rice?
I tried Condoleezza Rice. She wouldn't stop for questions.
Well, she's at Stanford now.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, not in my neck of the woods.
next time you come visit us here in Northern California, I'll put you up if you promise that we can ambush her together.
Right. Well, I actually don't think of it as ambushing because, you know, I mean, you know, I go to these Sunday morning talk shows because, you know, these politicians, they go on these talk shows and they get asked denial questions and they give deceitful answers. Then they step out of the Sunday morning talk shows and very frequently. There's another camera crew there from some establishment network, and I ask them the same banal questions. So I go there with a cameraman in tow, and, you know, try to ask them real, actual, tough questions.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you're doing the hard work. Let me ask you one question about money before I turn some of the questions over to our my co-host here for this show, Jeff Blankford. Jeff, by the way, is the former editor of the Middle East Labor Bulletin and the founder of the Labor Committee of the Middle East and a real expert on Israel and Israel's spycraft and nuclear weapons program. And we'll get to Jeff in a second. I wanted to ask you, Sam, about the money, and let's go back to the beginning. On the 10th of March, 1965, the United States and Israel had the Eskol-Comer memorandum of understanding, which said that contained Israel's written assurance that it would not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons in the Middle East. Thereafter, you had the French helping them build their first nuclear reactor. And I have friends who actually are senior officers in the Air Force and both retired and active duty. And looking at the estimated 200 to 300 nuclear warheads that Israel has, they say this is a $1 trillion industry. So never mind that UN inspectors can't go in and actually put their hands on these warheads. How do you get away with keeping a $1 trillion industry under the radar and going back to building the first nuclear reactor that Israel built with the French help? How was that kept a secret? How were the finances kept a secret?
I'm more a critic and try to reveal U.S. policy. I can't bill myself as an actual expert on the program itself, but I don't think that it was a secret.
Okay.
I think everybody knew, but they just simply agreed to not acknowledge it, to not admit it, to not discuss it, to keep it out of the public eye. I think to that end, it's largely been, look at what's happened to Iran. Iraq got disarmed and then deposed and invaded. Basically the same with Libya, got rid of their WMD programs. There's been constant talk of a WMD program with Iran, even though there's no evidence for it. And meanwhile, there's no public discussion whatever about the Israeli program, and I think that they're not acknowledging it. I think there could be several reasons for not acknowledging it, but one of them is just simply to keep it out of the public eye, because once you acknowledge it, then you got questions, you got inspectors, you got how big is it, and so on and so forth. You don't acknowledge it, then there's no discussion about it. So it's this total asymmetry of U.S. policy that basically maintains an Israeli monopoly, although it's not an Israeli monopoly, because, you said that memorandum was that Israel wouldn't introduce nuclear weapons to the region, which technically is true because the U.S. probably has nuclear weapons in the region.
Right. On subs in the Persian Gulf.
right. So, in a very legalistic sense, it's probably true, but they're the first country in the region.
Well, Israel has been obsessed with the nuclear weapons program, and this is not an opinion. This is a fact. Going back to their first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, in talking about the Holocaust from reoccurring, and he stated, and this is an exact quote, he said, "What Einstein, Oppenheimer, and Teller have done for the United States, and all three of them are Jews, what they made for the United States should have been done by them in Israel for their own people." This is David Ben-Gurion in 1948. Let me turn this over to Jeff Blankford. Jeff?
Well, that's a very interesting comment. Actually, President Kennedy had meetings with David Ben-Gurion, which were not very pleasant. President Kennedy was actually serious about Israel not having nuclear weapons, and he even allowed them to have A-4 defense missiles as an alternative. And Israel and Ben-Gurion was giving the President Kennedy and U.S. inspectors a runaround. I want to bring this up to date. Of course, our mainstream media goes along with the same fiction. We never have any of our columnists talking about the hypocrisy or the contradictions of talking about Iran's proposed nuclear weapons program or suspect nuclear weapons program. They never mentioned that Israel actually has nuclear weapons. And what's interesting is an article up from Reuters, just on the 17th, very Orwellian. The United States said on Tuesday that an Arab push to single out Israel for criticism over its assumed nuclear arsenal would hurt diplomatic efforts to ban weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East. Sam, maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. policy is simply geared towards making sure that Arab and Muslim states don't have WMDs, and there have been efforts to, you know, have a comprehensive discussion. I don't know if you saw a recent New York Times editorial op-ed by two rather mainstream folks, and it came late into the Syria crisis, but it basically acknowledged the same thing, that the U.S. stance really is ridiculous. They actually use the word ridiculous, or at least it looks that way in international quarters. So, I mean, for the U.S. to say that a push to acknowledge Israel's nuclear weapons or to have a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East, or at least have talks on these lines, it hurts disarmament. No, it doesn't. It can help disarmament. It can help peaceful disarmament. But it might lead to the eventual Israeli disarmament or to at least integrate it into the, you know, into the legal system. Israel is the only country in the region that hasn't signed a nuclear non-proliferation treaty, for instance.
Well, I should also mention that Israel shares a distinction with Myanmar of being the only two countries that have not ratified, who have signed the chemical weapons ban, but have not ratified it.
Right, and there doesn't seem to be any prospect of Israel ratifying it in the near term. And the U.S. and Israel similarly won't acknowledge that program exists as well.
Also, I would classify, and others have classified, white phosphorus as a chemical weapon. And the Israelis used white phosphorus in Lebanon in 1982, and they used it again in 2008. And this is, and actually people watch this. Of course, the United States used white phosphorus and napalm and Agent Orange in Vietnam and provided Saddam Hussein with chemical weapons and the targets of Iranian military in their war. So there's a lot of hypocrisy going on all around, which doesn't seem to be acknowledged in Washington, although it does get mentioned once in a while in the magazines and in the press. Perhaps you comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the very few times that this is discussed, they try to draw distinctions between how white phosphorus is used and if it's really an incendiary chemical weapon, the way, you know, sarin or something is. But it's just sort of playing games and trying to ignore the real dramatic human impact of the use of things that both Israel and the United States have used with impunity. White phosphorus, napalm, depleted uranium.
Cluster bombs.
Cluster bombs as well. The U.S. actually just sold a ton of cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia, which is sort of the other, you know, oppressive leg of U.S. Middle East policy. One leg is Israel and the other leg is Saudi Arabia. There's just a consistent pattern of the U.S. either doing this or facilitating its allies. doing this.
Sam, I've got, we only have a half an hour with you, and I want to leave time for at least one listener call. I have a lot of unanswered questions that have to do with, again, the finances and the logistics of a trillion-dollar nuclear weapons program, not the least of which how Israel gets their hands on the uranium to produce the plutonium, and how they may have tested their nuclear weapons over time. But one of the things that intrigues me, one of the sidebar stories that intrigues me the most here, is the rumor. And I want to know what you know about it, and if you've worked to confirm it at all, that Israel may have started negotiations to sell nuclear warheads, namely to South Africa. In 2010, The Guardian released South African documents that alleged and confirmed the existence of Israel's nuclear arsenal. And according to The Guardian, the documents were minutes that were taken from the South African side of alleged meetings between senior officials from the two countries in 1975. The Guardian further alleged that these documents reveal that Israel had offered to sell South Africa nuclear weapons in that year, 1975. And the documents appear to confirm information disclosed by a former South African naval commander, Dieter Gedhardt, who was jailed in 1983 for spying for the Soviet Union, who said there was, in fact, an agreement between Israel and South Africa involving an offer by Israel to arm 8 Jericho missiles with atomic weapons. Do you know anything about that?
I remember when those reports came out, and I believe that a gentleman wrote a book about the South African bomb that was part of those revelations.
Right, Avner Cohen.
That there was this level of cooperation between the two. I don't know anything else about it beyond that, but it makes sense at a lot of different levels. I mean, there was diplomatic cooperation as well between Israel and South Africa during that period, so it would totally make sense.
All right, we're going to take a few calls now. Our phone number is 707-895-2448, 707-895-2448. And the book that we were talking about, Avner Cohen's book, is the title is Israel and the Bomb and the Worst-Kept Secret, Israel's Bargain with the Bomb. Jeff, let's go to our first call.
Okay, we do have a caller. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Is it safe to assume that the Israelis also have nuclear missile boats?
Well, they do have nuclear-armed submarines given to them by the Germans.
Okay, yeah, that's what I meant, submarines. And thus they have a second strike capability.
That's right.
So if everyone talks about the Iranians wiping Israel off the map, but in doing that, wouldn't they also destroy Palestine?
Sam?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't think that it's ever been perceived as a serious threat to Israel. I think the concern from Israel, from the Israeli establishment and the U.S. establishment, would that there would be some kind of deterrence to Israel's nuclear monopoly, increasingly there isn't one. I mean, in real brute force terms, if you don't have, Iraq, now Syria, Libya, the only country that seems to have a WMD program that isn't about to be terminated is Egypt, and that's in a coup government and increasingly in a state of chaos.
You don't think the Saudis don't have the capability to build a bomb?
The Saudis probably have something. They're rather opaque as well. But they're not. They are part of the U.S. orbit. They don't constitute a meaningful deterrent to Israel, at least at this point. They quite frequently are in cooperation and cahoots with the state of Israel on Syria, on the Iraq war, on a whole series of things. They don't recognize each other formally, but there is massive tacit cooperation between Saudi Arabia and Israel.
We're going to take one more call, Sam.
Sure. Hi, this is Jason Olson. John asked me to call in to the show.
Yes. Good morning, Jason. Thank you for calling in, and why don't you identify yourself?
I'm a PhD student at Brandeis University in Middle East Studies.
You're also a scholar. You're a fellow, rather.
Yes. Yes, sir.
And why don't you tell us, just identify that fellowship program you're part of.
Sure.
You there,
Jay? Yep, I'm here.
That fellowship program you're part of,
Schusterman Center for Israel Studies.
Yes, and you're also one of the speakers on the Speakers Bureau at the that the Israeli Embassy has posted.
Sir.
Yes. Do you have a question for Sam?
Yes. I'm here. I wanted to. It's the Schusterman Center for Israel Studies.
And what question do you have for Sam?
My question is about the non-proliferation treaty. A nuclear non-proliferation treaty, and the fact that Israel most likely developed nuclear weapons before the NPT became an international norm in 1968, and Israel thus became part of the original six countries, the first six countries that had nuclear weapons, and I just wanted to comment on that. That Israel, it basically got in before, this non-proliferation philosophy became part of international relations, and now that there's a goal to prevent new states from getting nuclear weapons, and it's basically too late to push Israel in this direction.
Sam?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Other declared nuclear powers are still signatories to the treaty. Israel is not a signatory to the treaty, either as a declared power or claiming not to be a nuclear power. So, I think that there's a lot of, ways that this could go, and the origins of it are complicated. The central point is that you can't begin to pretend to get anywhere with this, dishonesty, the fact that Israel won't acknowledge its nuclear weapons program, the fact that the U.S. won't acknowledge Israel's nuclear program. So it can become a signatory as a nuclear weapons power, and we can, go from there and try to work towards disarmament. I mean, the U.S. under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is supposed to be disarming as well. That was the pact that, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was supposed to say, you countries that don't have nuclear weapons, don't get them, and we countries that do, we will seriously work towards getting rid of them. Now, the U.S. has basically reneged on that, or at least stalled indefinitely, but that's supposed to be the bargain that was struck.
Sam, we're going to wrap it up with you. I want to thank you so much for being a guest. My final question before we end up with your contact information again is in reaching out for balance on this program and what have you, I heard from a number of people in Israel who were part of the peace movement there, who were pro-Israel but anti-nuke. And it seems that the peace movement is a lot more alive and well in Israel than it is right here in the United States. In even bringing this subject up here in the United States, some people label you as an anti-Semite, this, that, and the other thing. Why do you think that's the case? Why do you think that's the third rail, this whole issue of Israel and its nuclear weapons program here in the United States, but not in Israel?
Yeah, it's kind of, boggles my mind because, it's clear as day, and sometimes it feels like, talking to a fish about water. It's the massive, reality on the Middle East, if you're talking about it militarily, that there are, somewhere between 60 and 400 nuclear weapons right there, and they cast an enormous shadow throughout the region, and yet virtually nobody talks about it.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right, Sam, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. I bow to you. I mean, literally bow to you. I'm sitting in my chair now, but if I didn't have headphones and a microphone in front of me, I would bow to you for referring so many great guests to our program over the last 6 years from the Institute for Public Accuracy.
Amen.
And Jeff and all of our public affairs programmers would echo that as well throughout the country. I mean, I've been on shows at Al Jazeera and BBC and Sirius XM. And, you know, I've been preceded by people who were referred to all these media outlets from the Institute for Public Accuracy. So the work you're doing is central to getting progressives on the air and in fighting the dominance of mainstream media and the conglomeration of media. So, Sam Husseini, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John. Very kind of you.
Thank you. And once again, where listeners can find out more about your work?
Accuracy.org. And if they just do a Google search on my name, Sam Husseini, they'll find my blog as well, which has some additional stuff. But the main thing is accuracy.org.
Sam Husseini, of the Communications Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and the author of See No Evil, The Absurd U.S. Stance on Israeli Nukes, thank you so much for being on our program.
And thank you, Sam.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye, John. Bye, Jeff.
So there you have it. Great program. We're going to get Grant Miller on the show next. I'm sorry, Grant Smith. Why did I say Grant Miller? Grant Smith. Grant is a guest that has appeared many times on Jeff's program. He is another American foreign policy expert in the Middle East. He follows Israel's agenda and spycraft and in their nuclear weapons industry. He has documented the enormous cost to our treasury, the U.S. Treasury, and the U.S. economy, as well as the putting countless American lives in jeopardy there in the Middle East. This, of course, is the money program. That's what I'm interested in,
hey, Grant,
the enormous costs of some of our missteps in foreign policy to the United States economy. He's written a wonderful book called Spy Trade, How Israel's Lobby Undermines the American Economy. And he's kind of an expert in the Israeli lobby, APEC. I want to welcome Grant F. Smith to our show. Grant, welcome to our show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So I don't know if you've thank you for being on the show. I don't know if you've heard the web stream of the first
half. I have.
Yeah. For any comments, for first blush, yeah. what would you say? How would you follow up on Sam?
Yeah, I would follow up on Sam. You have some really key questions about finance. And since this is a financial show, I think we should just dive right into that.
Do it, brother. Do it.
The story with Israel is that it really relies on the United States, in particular, various interest groups to support it, and that's no secret. So what you have with the War of Independence, for example, is heavy reliance on Americans to supply conventional arms. And you had a lot of smuggling operations going on, Al Schwimmer and company, Hank Greenspun, that were later lionized in movies and books, and then actually launched some of Israel's formal industry, like Israel Aircraft Industries. That was started by Schwimmer. And it's kind of the same story with the nuclear weapons program. You have a lot of support that took place. And you mentioned Abner Cohen's excellent book, Israel and the Bomb. He also mentions that one key fundraiser, Abraham Feinberg, started raising money for the Israeli nuclear weapons program. And he did that through a lot of above-board dinners and fundraisers and reaching out to people. So, yeah, it's interesting because the American Committee for the Wiseman Institute is still out there. The Institute for Defense Analyses once did a study for the Pentagon called Critical Technology Issues in Israel, in which they outright stated, hey, this organization is involved in cutting-edge high-energy physics, laser enrichment, quote, needed for nuclear bomb design, unquote. So We can say with certainty that it's not formalized. The Israeli nuclear weapons program has gotten a lot of its finance for this, as you say, trillion-dollar industry from American nonprofits. And I thought it was kind of ironic. The caller who came in from Brandeis University, supported by Charles and Lynn Schusterman Foundation, they also support the Weizmann Institute, the American Committee for the Weizmann Institute. So right. The money is flowing. And Americans also should realize that by heavily subsidizing and providing grants to the tune of $3 billion a year for conventional weapons, they're sort of offsetting all of this expense that Israel has been able to dedicate to its nuclear arsenal. So that's just a really key point. And a lot of the pieces to this puzzle are out there, but as you both said, they're not really discussed in the mainstream media.
Yeah, I find it inconceivable that you can, you know, keep a trillion-dollar industry submerged, keep it under the radar. I can understand
right.
nuclear weapons programs being secret. That I can understand. You know, Pakistan got away with it. India got away with it. South Africa got away with it. North Korea got away with it. Hey, it's nukes. It's going to be secret. It's part of the territory.
Right.
But a trillion-dollar industry, you know, when we're talking about Israel being probably having the third-largest nuclear arsenal in the world, and the money that went to funding that, to building that, going to the 60 million francs back in the early 1960s, where the Israeli Macon 4 transferred key patents from the French to help weaponize what's called G1 plutonium production reactor at the UP1 reprocessing plant.
There's also been some American input to that as well. The Bulletin of American Scientists has an excellent article that's free and up online now called Revisiting the NUMEC Affair, which convincingly and definitively states that some of the driver fuel for the Dimona plant was diverted from a front organization in Pennsylvania called the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation.
Right.
That just happened to be run by two executives of the Zionist Organization of America. Now, Victor Galinsky, who wrote that piece, also has a piece in the New York Times yesterday, which questions why America continues with this obstacle of its own making, as he puts it, in supporting the idea that we don't know Israel has nuclear weapons. And the answer to that question, and really to Sam Husseini's brilliant work tracking all of these politicians and getting them to say on camera that they don't know anything, that they're, you know, this completely ignorant set of people, is that once you start pulling the thread, once you get on this train, you see a train of corruption that goes back decades in which American politicians, law enforcement in not enforcing the 1954 Atomic Energy Act, investigations of capers like NUMEC, investigation of the diversion of Crytrons from Huntington Beach in California and Textronics oscillators in 2010.
Right.
What you realize is that the American flow of materials, money, technology, know-how has been ongoing. And it seems to follow this two-step process, where first this sort of thing is taken, as in the conventional weapons smuggling, and then it's ultimately legitimized. Except on this point, the U.S. is in the gray area of turning a blind eye, but not actually accepting in open arms and legitimating and saying, well, this is our new nuclear friend in the Middle East. We haven't gotten to that point yet.
We're going to go to Jeff. Jeff?
Grant, you mentioned Crytons, the nuclear triggers, and that was an interesting case because you revealed recently that the Israeli end of a smuggling operation of nuclear triggers from California which sent one gentleman named Richard Smythe to prison.
Yeah.
The Israeli end was none other than the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. The FBI did not redact his name from the file that was released, which you have put on your archive.
Yeah, on July 4, we put out a story about that. The FBI released files in which Richard Kelly Smythe, when he was being debriefed for having smuggled hundreds of nuclear triggers out of the U.S. after they captured him overseas and brought him back, he implicated Benjamin Netanyahu in an Israeli front company called Heli Trading as being his primary contact in Israel. Now, of course, the U.S. press downloaded the documents, as did everybody else, but they didn't see fit to report on that, which is fairly typical for this sort of thing. And, you know, cutting to the chase, both of you mentioned this famous 1969 meeting between Nixon and Golda Meir, in which they decided that they were never going to openly discuss the Israeli nuclear weapons program. They did it for one simple reason, and you can see this in Kissinger's memos to Nixon. They didn't want to withhold phantom aircraft in punishment for Israel going nuclear. They didn't want to take any of these steps because they were afraid of domestic political backlash from Israel lobbying organizations and the campaign contributions that they withhold. It's as simple as that.
Incidentally, talking about Sam Husseini's work and trying to pin down American senior people in Congress and in the White House,
yes,
just to admit Israel's got weapons, and everyone says, "I don't know," "I'm not going to touch that third rail," or "I get too much money for AIPAC in my campaign
right.
finance committee," or whatever. He mentioned right. that Jimmy Carter may have let the cat out of the bag. And in fact, and in my research for this show, I was able to actually find that speech, that admission in BBC News on Monday, May 26, 2008. Ex-President Jimmy Carter said definitively, Israel has 150 nuclear weapons. This was in 2008. I'm sure they have more by now. He also described the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians as, quote, one of the greatest human rights crimes on earth. And this is a matter of record. We have a former president
right.
stating that Israel has got 150 weapons. Of course, the United States has got more than 12,000 nuclear weapons. The Soviet Union has about the same. France and Great Britain probably around what Israel has as well. And given the failings of enormous capabilities to destroy the world, and not only of weaponry, but also of delivery systems, it's going to take one misstep in the command and control infrastructure to start a war.
Right.
Just so we have it on record. Jimmy Carter did say it.
But one of the important things to know about Jimmy Carter is that among his last acts in office, he ordered the Central Intelligence Agency to turn over thousands of documents about the diversion of weapons-grade material from Pennsylvania to Israel to the Internal Security Section of the Justice Department.
Yeah.
None of those documents have ever been released. The Justice Department won't release memos about why it didn't prosecute Americans under the Atomic Energy Act for diverting uranium. And so Carter was very brave decades after leaving office to finally fess up, becoming the first American president to admit that. But when he was in power and had the ability to actually enforce U.S. laws intended to prevent diversion, his administration failed to do so,
right.
and they didn't pass any of the criminal prosecution information to the Reagan administration.
Right, right. Incidentally, for listeners who are following this, Jimmy Carter made that admission in 2008 in the United Kingdom at the Literary Hayes Festival in Wales.
Well, also, when Carter was president, Israel and South Africa exploded or were believed to conducted a nuclear test in the
Indian Ocean.
In the Indian Ocean, perhaps you could comment on that, Grant.
Yeah, absolutely. The Vela satellite, which is a U.S. spy satellite looking at the horizon, detected nuclear flashes. And they were aware of the fact that Israelis and South Africans were conducting a test offshore. But again, when you had all of this coming to the attention of people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and other issues about proliferation and Israel, for the most part, their memos say, do not disseminate, do not brief, do not discuss. And you have senators such as Senator Glenn coming to their office and saying, what about this? And, of course, Glenn is one of the authors of the Glenn Amendments to the U.S. foreign aid legislation, which says the U.S. legally cannot and will not give foreign aid to countries that are actively involved in nuclear proliferation or operating outside the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So we can laud Carter for finally fessing up to Israel's nukes, but he did absolutely nothing to enforce the Glenn and Symington amendments to U.S. foreign aid legislation, and they also didn't really allow anybody to take action on what they found out through the Vela intercepts.
Yeah. Regarding that nuclear testing, this comes from a very high and credible source, retired Colonel Warner D. Farr, in a report to the United States Air Force Counterproliferation Center, admitted as much to this test. And
right.
West Germany's Army Magazine, Werdechik, it's a military technology magazine, also reported this in June of 1976. And then later we had the what's known as the Vela incident on September 22nd, 1979. There was a possible South African nuclear bomb, probably sold by Israel, was tested in the southern Indian Ocean. A secret committee was set up by then President Jimmy Carter and headed by Professor Jack Runita of MIT to investigate this. It was a small tactical nuclear weapon. For those listeners interested in knowing more about that, just Google up the Vela incident, V-E-L-A incident. Jeff?
While we're mentioning South Africa, what I should mention, interesting piece of information I found in Arthur Hertzberg's History of Jews in America. Arthur Hertzberg was an official of the American Jewish Congress. He met with Congressman Charles Rangel when he was just in office. Congressional Black Caucus kept a unforgivable silence about Israel's collaboration with South Africa during that whole period. And Hertzberg described in his book how he met with Charles Rangel and made a deal as long as the Congressional Black Caucus would keep its silence about Israel's dealings with South Africa, there would be no problem about the Jewish members of Congress and the American Jewish establishment giving support to the black agenda in terms of economic aid to black communities in America. So the trade-off was in voting for welfare, continuing welfare, food stamps, things like that, that the black community leadership was interested in, the Black Caucus would keep its silence on South Africa, which unfortunately it did.
Well, it's interesting just to see how this entire sort of funding and pressure campaign actually work. I mean, it's interesting also to note that there was a time when Israel's nuclear fundraising coordinator, again, as per Avner Cohen's book, Israel and the Bomb, had raised so much cash for Lyndon B. Johnson that it was literally brimming in his safe, hundreds of thousands of dollars for campaign efforts. And when there was a minor sexual scandal, Bill Moyers and an assistant, as detailed in the excellent Cy Hirsch book, The Samson Option, had to move all of that cash. And so, you know, you have these high figures, highly influential figures, again, with dual roles of fundraisers for American presidents, but also working on this clandestine fundraising operation, so close, so integrated into the corridors of power. That, again, it makes Sam Husseini's work completely understandable. Once you pull on this thread, once you get on this train, once you ask all of the follow-up questions, it's something that the White House and American politicians, it's a place they just don't want to go.
You bet. And it's all about money, be it the trillion-dollar industry and funding the reactors, and in building the bombs and in testing them and in developing the weapons delivery systems. $1 trillion under the radar. But because this is a money program, Grant, I want you to also talk about the role of money and AIPAC and how money and AIPAC is used to keep these secrets secret in Washington.
Sure. Well, if you go to any major AIPAC confab, you're going to see a couple of things, like the 2010 one. You're going to see all of the key members of Congress lined up there, and there'll be a roll call, and they'll stand up and talk about their dedication and whatnot, because they know that major contributors and political action committees and bundlers are also at that conference. But then you'll also subsequently see video presentations lauding the Wiseman Institute of Science, you know, not talking about the nuclear weapons program, but lauding its technological achievements and spin-offs. So it absolutely is an industry. It's a political machine like nobody has ever seen. And it's also been able to skirt the law a number of times. It's been caught in the 80s, coordinating ostensibly independent political action committees, but never paid a price for that. There's the case of Michael Goland, an AIPAC director who fixed an election for Alan Cranston there in California by having Ed Vallon be a spoiler candidate during the Senate elections in 1986. And, of course, Cranston went on to give all sorts of aid to Israel, and the felony conviction of Goland never affected his trajectory. So there's also a lot of corruption that's enabled these organizations to gain the heights that they've gained. But it's absolutely appropriate to talk about it on the money program because it's technology spinoff, it's funding flows, it's secrets, and it's not good for America, frankly. It's we're kind of playing the role of beating on the SEC's door and alerting them to a Ponzi scheme and being ignored like Harry Markopoulos was in all of those decades before they finally cracked down and caught Bernie Madoff.
All right. I want to remind our listeners, we're talking here about the double standard between President Obama's attitude towards weapons of mass destruction in Syria with chemical weapons, which is an abomination that anyone would use nerve gas on civilians and children, special place in hell for those Syrians who would do that. But when it comes to Israel, and it's estimated 200 to 300 nuclear warheads. Our administration, our country is strangely silent about this $1 trillion industry. It is not a joke. We're talking about suitcase bombs. Semir Hirsch has reported that Israel has fully developed the ability to miniaturize warheads small enough to fit in a suitcase. We're talking about tactical nuclear weapons that can fit into 175 millimeter or 203 millimeter self-propelled artillery shells that would be firing nuclear shells. There are three battalions of these 175 millimeter tubes reportedly armed with 108 nuclear shells and an unknown number of 203 millimeter shells pointed at Israeli enemies on their border. We're talking about Israel's enemies beyond its borders, missiles pointed towards Iran, much of Middle East, perhaps Europe. We're talking about EPM, electromagnetic strike capabilities. Israel reportedly possesses several 1 megaton bombs. And to give you a sense of scale, if a 1 megaton class bomb were to be detonated 400 meters above Omaha, Nebraska, the entire continent of the United States would be affected with potentially damaging EMP experience. We're talking about enhanced radiation weapons, what's known as neutron bombs. Israel has an unknown number of neutron bombs. And we're talking about landmines, nuclear landmines that are on the border between Israel and Syria in the Golan Heights. This is not a joke. This is a $1 trillion industry. And it's also a multi-billion dollar industry that the Israeli lobby has right here in the United States to keep this all secret. Grant, we'll let you have the final word. I'm pro-Israel but anti-nuke. I think this is the nerve gas in Syria is an excellent opportunity for the president to take a leadership position and banning all weapons of mass destruction, including nukes, in the Middle East. How can we get from here to there?
Yeah, I think you've done a great service in tackling this issue on your show. And, of course, the simple answer was once proposed by Steve Rosen, the top AIPAC lobbyist, and that's sunlight. You can't have a policy of nuclear ambiguity where only politicians are the adults sitting at the big boy table and nobody else gets to even talk knowledgeably about what's going on, including all of the facts you just mentioned. You can't have this sort of policy in the United States where we are perceived globally as anti-proliferation because we've allowed this huge exception to the rule. The bottom line is that Americans need to start talking about this and insisting their politicians, as Sam Husseini, talk intelligently and clearly about this issue so that we can all move toward these non-proliferation goals that are intended to keep this tripwire, this potential Holocaust, from occurring.
All right.
Grant, we can have a few more minutes. We've been told Gordon Black, who with the wondrous world of music, has not arrived yet, so we have a few more minutes.
You mean the wondrous Gordon Black?
Yes. Has not arrived yet, and so we can continue this a bit
wonderful.
More. You know, it's interesting. In today's Washington Post, the new president of Iran has an op-ed, in which he really wants to sit down and negotiate the problems that are potentially leading us toward war. And his replacement, having replaced Ahmadinejad, who the head of AIPAC. One of the presidents of AIPAC said Ahmadinejad was a gift that keeps on giving. You might comment on the dismay of the part of the Israel lobby network in Washington on the election of Rouhani.
Yeah, I think they're disappointed. As one lobbyist said, Ahmadinejad was a gift who kept on giving with all of his fiery rhetoric, some of which was admittedly intentionally mistranslated. But Rouhani is kind of laying down a marker saying that he wants there to be real discussions and open discussions of the real issues, particularly of proliferation. That hasn't happened in the last decade or so, where most Americans probably think Iran is brimming with nuclear weapons and Israel is defenseless when actually the situation is reversed. But I think it's going to be important for people who want to receive this president in the United States and hear what he has to say and get above and beyond all of this hype that we've been experiencing in the last 10 years to write about it and to hold their media and politicians' feet to the fire and honestly reporting any diplomatic breakthroughs or entreaties that are going on, as opposed to attempting to find the way to demonize this olive branch.
You're listening to Takes All About Money with John Sackwitz and co-host Jeff Blankford here today on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Williston, Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. The time is 10 o'clock. For those who are tuning in for Gordon Black and Wondrous World of Music, Gordon has not arrived yet, so we're going to continue this a little bit more. Grant, you have been making a major effort to get the American Israel Public Affairs Committee to register as a foreign agent because it is acting on behalf, and it actually registered to lobby for Israel. Perhaps you could give a little bit of history of that, which most of our listeners probably wonder, why is this lobby so powerful?